Oh, hello everyone. Hi. Please have a seat if you're not already seated. Thank you everyone for coming today to our seminar on, on advancing the rights of sex workers in the age of Brexit. I think that's what we finalize it.
Hello.
Thank you. My name is Lucas Stevenson. I'm a sex worker and an activist in different sex worker groups in the UK, like Sex Worker Open University, Scott Pep, so volunteering for Umbrella Lane. I'll be chairing the panels, and I guess we're just going to start directly. I just had like, some announcements that the panels, the speakers will be filmed, so The person filming will not be filming the room, so don't worry about that. Only the speakers who have agreed to be filmed will be filmed. And just maybe a few words about the seminar and how it's taking place. So this is the second day of our Festival of Resistance, Sex Workers Festival of Resistance, which is taking place from Wednesday till Saturday. Yesterday we had a sex worker only day with different workshops. Today we have the seminar. Tonight at THT, Terence Higgins Trust, we have a panel of LGBT sex workers discussing the relationship between the LGBT community and sex workers' rights. Tomorrow we have some workshop for sex workers only, as well as a party with performances. And in the it's at Killing Park Complex, so you're all invited to attend the party. And the following day is a film festival at the CCA. And as you probably know, this festival takes place. This festival takes place in a time of quite turbulent political times. So we call it, advancing the right of sex workers in the age of Brexit, partly because of this decision of the UK last year to, decision of the UK. Well, let's not go into details about that, but, the political changes are happening, not just in the UK, but globally, with a rise of right-wing populism, increase of xenophobia and racism, anti-migrants discourses, as well as a kind of pushback against women's rights, reproductive rights, LGBT communities. And sex workers are often members of many other communities. Many sex workers are migrant sex workers. A majority of sex workers are women and mother, single mother. Many sex workers are people from the trans community or the LGBT community, etc. So sex workers are often at the intersection of many groups which are already criminalized or stigmatized or are facing rights violation, etc. So we wanted to have this panel today to discuss a bit more in depth with activists, sex worker rights activists, migrant sex workers, activists from the feminist movement and reproductive justice, to try to discuss a bit more the intersection of these issues. So I will. How is it going to work? Hello. We will have the speakers, so each speaker will speak for around 5-7 minutes each on the issue at hand. And then we will have a couple of, the speaker will sit here and we'll have a Q&A, I'll ask a couple of questions, and then it will be open to the public, to you all, to ask questions. Or maybe I'll say that now, so of course sex work or prostitution is a very controversial and polarized debate. And we really welcome the input of everyone. We do ask that people's identities and agency are respected. So we are sex workers. We define what we do as sex work, as a form of work, and we demand that it is respected. We do not agree and we do not accept the conflation of prostitution with violence. We know the difference between violence and sex work. Many of us are survivors of violence as well, and we want to make it clear that while we accept discussion and we welcome discussion with people who do not agree with our perspective, we also really strongly believe that we should not be, our experience should not be denied. The same way that we ask that we respect the experience of survivors of violence, we also demand that our experiences as workers are respected. So I hope we can have a constructive debate and Q&A during the seminar. So I'm going to call the first panelist for the first panel. So the first panel is on sex workers' rights and reproductive justice strategizing together. And the first speaker is Catriona O'Brien, who is a sex worker and activist with Sex Workers Alliance Ireland. Thank you very much.
Let me see if I got this right. Okay, right. Okay, firstly, thank you for inviting me to speak on this. I just wanted to correct Luca. It's actually Catriona, but it's just because it's the Irish way of writing Catriona. firstly, I feel really privileged to be speaking on a panel with such great speakers. So I'm going to specifically talk about this in an Irish context, because that's what I'm familiar with. And I'm going to just explain both the laws in terms of the criminalisation that we experience, both with abortion and sex work. So for me, reproductive justice and sex work have always been intertwined. I live in Ireland, where both sex work and abortion are heavily criminalised. For a quick background, Ireland, both north and south, criminalised the purchase of sex, brothel keeping, so two or more sex workers sharing premises, solicitation, internet advertising, but if a sex worker solicits on the street, that is decriminalised in both north and south. Third parties, so someone managing phones, security, taxis, etc., that's criminalised too. So it's pretty similar to the rest of the UK, except client criminalisation. Abortion is illegal in Ireland in almost all cases, except when the woman's life is in danger. This also applies to the north of Ireland, something a lot of feminists in the rest of the UK tend to forget about, something I find absent from the abortion rights campaign in the UK, who get obsessed about the gag order in the States around abortion, but then don't comment about the situation right next to them in the same jurisdiction. Abortion seekers in the north can go to other parts of the UK to get an abortion, but are not covered by the NHS and have to bear the burden of costs themselves, which can reach up to £2,000 or even more. In both north and south of Ireland, abortion pills are increasingly becoming the option for abortion seekers because they're much cheaper at a suggested donation of €80 by organisations such as Women Help With Women and Women on Web. The pills are sent via the north, as customs were more lax about letting the packages in, whereas in the south they are often intercepted. Abortion activists north and south work together to transport these abortion pills, but now increasingly we're seeing more and more abortion seekers being given suspended sentences in the north for having abortions by such means. In the south of Ireland, facilitating someone to have an abortion in the country can lead to imprisonment for 14 years. This particular law is not an old law, it was introduced in 2013. Pro-choice activists have seen their homes raided by the police service in Northern Ireland to find these pills. People are finding increasingly more and more difficult to access these pills. I really wanted to highlight here is how the criminalisation of sex work and abortion is really about the criminalisation of the poor and the most marginalised. We see asylum seekers unable to cross the border over to the UK to access abortion abroad. So even between the north and south, if you take a bus, for example, the police will sometimes come in and then check basically who's the person of colour who's there and then see if they have the right papers. Abortion pills are an obvious choice for both. We see asylum seekers unable to cut to access and the poor unable to access abortion because they cannot afford it. Abortion pills are an obvious choice for both. Asylum seekers and survival sex workers are on the street are unable to screen clients properly as the client is nervous negotiating in the public due to client criminalisation. They face the brunt of this criminalisation. These people are the low-hanging fruit to be targeted by the police. These people, many of whom are women, are often also caregivers who are doing sex work to provide for other dependents or need an abortion as they can't afford another child. Both movements face this criminalisation of the poor, which is oft feminised. Criminalisation means sex workers and people who need abortions are made to feel that state institutions do not have their best interests at heart. people who take abortion pills often fear presenting at a hospital if they experience complications. We've seen this in the north multiple times, a few times where someone's presented that they took the abortion pills and then the doctor will report them to the police. And there's one woman who was given, who is going through the courts at the moment for this. Sex workers may feel unable to go to the police if they are robbed or assaulted at their workplace. Individuals know they may face the humiliation of being chastised for their decision, bribes, or perhaps even arrested. Since its inception, the Irish state has sought to control women's bodies and sexuality. Pervasive social stigma and hostility towards women and girls who seek abortions and stigma and discrimination against sex workers are underpinned by the belief that women in particular cannot be trusted to make decisions about their own bodies. The state assumes control over decisions relating to women's bodies and sexuality, emboldened to do so by widespread social complicity in the idea that if unchecked by the state's power and control, women's decision-making will automatically be bad, uninformed, irresponsible, or malicious. And so the state, directly or indirectly, criminalizes specific choices women may wish to make about their bodies, health, and sexuality, thereby limiting their options. We're in a time of where carceral feminism have influence over policymaking. Carceral feminism is an approach to fighting violence against women by increasing policing, prosecution, and imprisonment. Carceral feminists tend to be white, rich, cisgender women. People like Frances Fitzgerald are justice minister. Frances Fitzgerald used to be the head of the National Women's Council of Ireland. She was championed for women's equality for introducing climate criminalisation, which would not only criminalise the client as a sex worker, but also doubles the sentences for brothel keeping. I find it hard to champion someone for women's equality who continues to be justice minister over a country where abortion is criminalised and saw a woman die as the result of that criminalisation while her party was in power. I'd like to end to going back to my initial point, by which this is much to do with the criminalisation of poverty. I want to quote my friend Frankie Mullen's excellent article on this topic from the New Statesman. Sex work, DIY abortions, the controversial things we do with our bodies may convey inequalities and the desperation of our decisions, but they're not the inequalities themselves. These choices were made because of poverty and unequal access to resources. We need to recognise this and address that. Effective to stigma and the incredible ability of policy makers. Sorry, I messed that up there. But yeah, like a lot of what I really want to address here is I find a lot of this, especially in Ireland, is to do with how criminalisation of poverty is really the major issue and how it's particularly feminized with this. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Katrina. Did I say it right? Katrina.
Yes.
Oh my God, I'm sorry. Okay, the next speaker is Juno Mack, who's a sex worker activist, a member of Sex Worker Open University.
Hi. I'm thinking about building alliances between two movements. I think that's something that gets mentioned a lot in social justice spaces. And I think sometimes perhaps leans on what is potentially a bit of a glib way of saying that two movements are similar without really understanding what is similar about those two movements. And certainly when I first started doing sex worker activism, I heard a lot about reproductive justice way before I really broke down for myself what that meant. And I think it could be the same for activists in the room, so I'm going to talk a bit about that. I think a lot of people will have heard the kind of rhetoric that aligns sex worker rights with reproductive justice because both movements are at their core about women having control over their bodies and freedom to exercise their choices. And, you know, that kind of language is potentially an oversimplification of things, especially when we're talking about sex worker rights and abortion as separate things. But nonetheless, I do think that they get sort of clipped together in that way. Sometimes talking about choice is harmful in sex worker rights movements, and an over-reliance on the idea of choice or agency often hands weapons to opponents of sex worker rights, who say that really is not about choice because it's about the people who have a lack of choice. So we do tend to walk into traps if we stay in those areas. Another similarity between the two movements is that ultimately they are both controversial, even amongst feminists, amongst the women's movement. At some level, there's a point where both topics become divisive in ways that disappoint and dismay all of us. We've all seen discourse erupt into conflict around, you know, a topic or an example of a particular kind of bad woman who has accessed abortion or done sex work, who just takes it too far, whose strategies and decisions for survival just can't be defended. And really, for me, justice in these areas is about really looking at yourself and your own personal objections to such things, and thinking about why you have those objections. I was reminded just now during our chat before the thing of a celebrity in the UK a few years ago who went in the Big Brother house and very famously in the press got an abortion just before going on. So in order to go on the Big Brother TV show. And that caused huge controversy in the press, and a lot of people saying that, like, that was like the line. And it really reminded me at the time of people who draw lines about respectable kinds of sex work and non-respectable kinds of sex work sort of seemingly in the sand. You know, everybody has their limit. And it reminds me as well of the discourse in the press in the UK as well at the moment about sex for rent. You know, lots of sex workers, lots of prostitutes that I know are suddenly taking, like, offence at the idea that a person could trade sex for survival in that more casual way, and that gets at something in them that they find a bit confronting. So I think our internal politics within our movements, you know, even people who would identify as pro-choice were appalled at the Josie Cunningham story, and even sex worker rights who are very passionately for sex working autonomy are inclined to turn away from people in the sex trade who probably don't even identify as sex workers but who are trading sex to survive. Katrina mentioned the whiteness of the carceral feminist movement, but there is a whiteness in sex worker rights that we forget about a lot as well. Even the term sex worker is not accessible to everybody, and oftentimes the people who aren't describing themselves as sex workers are the people who should be at the forefront of our organizing. And that's the same all the way through. The people who are most affected and impacted by what we're trying to dismantle and overturn in our movements are the ones who are finding it the hardest to get a look in. Or they're the ones whose lives and experiences are sometimes being forgotten about or not strictly classified under reproductive justice or sex worker rights, like parents who are sex workers who are often unable to participate in organising just because it's so much work simply to keep one's head above water as a parent who does sex work. And criminalisation presents all kinds of obstructions to people trying to raise children and do sex work to support their families at the same time. And those experiences are very much invisibilised. I think the reproductive justice movement often has trouble identifying sex workers among them, purely because lots of data and statistics kind of leave sex workers a bit buried or left behind. A lot of studies done on sex workers in reproductive justice focus on HIV and AIDS and the idea of sex workers as vectors of risk, which elides the experiences that sex workers are having in the realm of forced healthcare. Invasive obstetric experiences, gynecological trauma, forced sterilization. Just earlier this year in Tehran, some government officials were talking about forcibly sterilizing sex workers and homeless women for the safety of the general population. That happened in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa in 2014, I think, with very little debate or controversy around it because of that logic that says sex workers are kind of risky and they should have that choice taken away from them, which is something that reproductive justice activists should really understand on a deep level. And I'm just going to leave with something that I learned from the blog of a feminist organizer called Emi Koyama, who talks a bit about the history of reproductive justice and how it was actually a response by women of color to the idea that the reproductive health and the reproductive rights movements weren't quite going far enough in addressing the need to empower women at a grassroots level and other people who need access to reproductive justice. So this justice framework replaces the limiting idea of just rights and health. And Emi Koyama says that that also can apply in sex worker rights. So instead of just thinking about rights, i.e. changing the law, instead of just thinking about health and access to services and creating those services, we should think about justice, which is a combination of those two, plus a way to empower the most marginalized among us. Because without that, all you really have is sex worker rights organizations, sometimes quite professionalized, asking for changes in the law. Health services that sometimes quite paternalistically provide services to sex workers, which is fundamental, but not enough by itself if you don't have a way to empower sex workers at a grassroots level. And if you go to Emi Koyama's blog, there's some really like clear information there setting out those two parallels and the way that that works. And that framework, that justice framework, can also apply to other movements too, like disability rights and other stuff like that. So I think it's important to recognize where those ideas have come from, and they do consistently come from women of color, who are the people, as Katrina said, often most left out of these discussions. And that's all I have to say for now.
So our first speaker is Shamindra, who is a research fellow at the School of History, Anthropology, Philosophy and Politics at Queen's University, Belfast. Shamindra finished a PhD in international politics in 2013 and is the first trans woman to be on a staff appointment. She's a board member of CBEAL, probably don't pronounce it right, the Irish Feminist and Gender Studies Network, and the LGBTQI officer of the Labour Party in Northern Ireland. Shamindra is Sri Lankan and has lived and worked in several places, including France and the Netherlands. She has an international she's an international LGBTQI activist and currently writing a book on trans identities and parenting, which draws on her lived experience as a trans woman and of color in Ulster and parents of two young children. There's more information than what I would just read. Thank you. And there's some water for you here.
Friends, Ayubovan. My name is Shamindra, and I'm Sri Lankan, and I'm a researcher and an activist, especially focusing on the reproductive rights of trans people, especially trans women. So I'm here to bring in a trans woman's, if not a trans woman of color perspective to this exchange of ideas, and to the organizers, I express my sincere gratitude for having us here. And especially to share some views from the perspective of a trans woman of color who is also a parent. And first of all, I must also say that I'm absolutely privileged to be here with the most important person in my life, my daughter Moksha. And so campaigns for reproductive justice are most often cisnormative places. So in Ireland, where I live, the campaign that calls for the repeal of the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, to the Bunreachtna Éireann, and the efforts to extend existing British legislation to Northern Ireland, and draft also more modern and advanced reproductive justice legislation, are the most important gender and social justice struggles of Ireland at the present time. Now, If you look at Northern Ireland, the foremost campaign for reproductive justice is named Trust Women. I'm sure many of you will be familiar with the hashtag Trust Women. Now, despite this key focus on cis women, today, increasingly, you do see that reproductive justice campaigns have increasingly moved towards using gender-inclusive language, standing for the rights of a birth giver's bodily autonomy. Now, the often sidelined reality is that reproductive justice, as the previous speaker, our friend who just spoke right before me, rightly affirmed, encompasses way beyond access to a safe and legal termination when a birth giver so decides. Existing debates and discourses on reproductive justice are often categorically ignore the case of trans and queer people. Now, when trans people's reproductive justice is parsimoniously evoked, the discussion often centers on and doesn't in most cases extend beyond certain demographics, certain categories like trans men, especially white trans men from middle class or upper middle class backgrounds in Turtle Island, for example. Now, it is crucial to highlight that trans people's reproductive rights are non-negotiable. So every human being, irrespective of their gender identity or sexual orientation, have an inalienable right to reproductive justice and to create a family, to have children on terms of their own. And being trans, if not being non-cis heteronormative, is by no means an impediment for parenting. Now, the reproductive rights of trans women continue to be marginalized, as you are well aware, and are seldom evoked within trans rights campaigns. Now, this is a critique that I have of some trans liberal organizations and campaigns. Regulations on compulsory sterilization now for trans women existed until recent years in many Western European countries that present themselves to the world as highly progressive in terms of human rights and gender equality. And in many of those countries, the laws have been changed only in the last couple of years. Now, the recent decision of the Strasbourg Court, the European Court of Human Rights, which adjudicates compulsory sterilization as contravening Article 8 of the European Convention of Human Rights, is legally binding only in the Republic of France. But however, this is an important decision because it's the first time a supranational court has affirmed, all by parsimoniously, the reproductive rights of trans people. Now, when it comes to reproductive justice, sex workers experience the most excruciating levels of marginalization and exclusion from activist advocacy and policy formulation initiatives. Now, the cishet society has created, as we are all well aware, a pseudo benchmark as such that unquestioningly assumes that a sex worker, by the very fact of exercising that livelihood, is incapable of, if not unsuitable for, parenting or simply to avail of their reproductive rights. Now, this is a level of extreme distortion of fact and an abject act of discrimination. So it is a set of narrowly construed assumptions that make sex work sound like a monolith. This is another problem, which it clearly is not. The reasons behind someone's choice of sex work, right, or the duration for which someone engages in sex work, for that matter, should in no way be reasons for them to be seen as incapable or unsuitable to exercise their reproductive rights and the right to have a family, the exact configuration of which each person is free to determine. Now, when what is required to begin with is not adding hay to the fire type stigmatization, but complete and fulsome decriminalization of sex work. Now, there should be no debate around full decriminalization, as the well-being of human beings depend on it, and as sex workers have affirmed time and again, improving the rights and working conditions of sex workers require full decriminalizing. As our friend who spoke before me affirmed, justice, in this case, justice via decriminalizing is the way forward. So it is the primary step, decriminalizing, is the primary step in terms of legislative provision and policy formulation that serves to guarantee fundamental rights, safety at work, and very especially full and non-stigmatizing and supportive access to healthcare. Now, these measures go hand in hand with recognizing sex workers' right to seek reproductive justice, and that it is only individual people. It is only individual people who should have a say in what they wish to do with their bodies in terms of reproductive justice, irrespective of their livelihood. Now, in other words, if I'm to sum up what I have to say in to one sentence, a sex worker's reproductive justice or sex worker's reproductive rights is not cis-heteronormative society's call in any way. So, a comprehensive policy and discourse on reproductive rights all should include fighting persistent stigma and prejudice against children. Parents who are sex workers face tremendous levels of violence, stigmatizing and marginalization from cis-het people, and indeed from some trans and queer people, unfortunately. And children become the frontline victims in this process as well. So what we should collectively fight for, is for a multi-pronged and multi-level multi-level approach in terms of policy, in terms of thinking about policy, which should include A, which decriminalizes and ensures the fundamental rights of sex workers and thereby works towards ending cishet stigma against sex workers and challenging rampant amalgamations and misunderstandings on sexual health, sex work, sexual orientations, and gender identities. Now, in sum, the struggle for reproductive justice needs to be a collective one. This is something that people are taking time to understand, unfortunately. And one in which trans women of color, trans men of color, gender plural peoples from across the world, from different sociocultural backgrounds, have a place, a definitive place in that collective struggle. The spirit of our collective struggle for reproductive justice can only be summed up by quoting the great Audre Lorde, as in that in your liberation lies my liberation, and that I am not free and that I will never be free for as long as you are unfree. Thank you.